From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out scribbling again this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Before Christmas Day, when a young Nigerian man with jihadist connections in Yemen allegedly tried to detonate explosives on a Detroit-bound airplane, there wasn't a whole lot of Yemen-centric reporting going on. Since then, many of us have had to play catch-up, and the media have done their best to provide the tutorials.
Coming up, is Yemen the new terror front?
Yemen is an ideal incubator for terrorism. It is the poorest Arab country in the world.
Is Yemen the new breeding ground for terrorists targeting America? A look 3 minutes away.
But as often happens when a previously ignored part of the world is suddenly thrust into the media spotlight, there have been mistakes, exaggerations, and a general lack of context running through the coverage. Some of that is understandable and inevitable. The news hole simply can't accommodate a Yemen history lesson with every story, and most journalists are playing catch-up, too. It's enough to make a Yemen expert, blogger, and former editor of the Yemen Observer, Brian O'Neill, cringe as he watches the coverage.
There definitely is a kind of dread. We were very nervous about what the tone was going to be and basically just ignorance about Yemen. I mean, understandable ignorance because it hadn't really been in the news at all.
What is being reported about Yemen that you think is either explicitly wrong or which is just kind of misdirection?
The media is focusing entirely on al-Qaeda with the mention of, oh, and there's a problem in the north and one in the south. Whereas in Yemen itself, al-Qaeda is essentially a sideshow. It's the third most important of these, of what we call the three rebellions. The one in the north takes a lot more of the government's time, and the one in the south is actually probably its biggest existential crisis, the one that really could force Yemen to no longer be the state that we know. We're focusing entirely on what should be done about al-Qaeda, what should the government of Yemen do about al-Qaeda, what should our government do. That's both giving al-Qaeda more power than they actually deserve to have, than they've actually earned, and ignoring the far greater crisis.
One of the factoids I keep hearing is that Yemen is Osama bin Laden's ancestral homeland.
What you may not realize is that Yemen is the ancestral home of Osama bin Laden.
Yemen has a special place in the history of al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden's father was born there.
Yemen, ancestral homeland of Osama bin Laden himself, is once again on al-Qaeda's front line.
When I hear that, you know, if I wasn't wearing headphones right now, steam would literally be shooting out of my ears. Like, that is the grandfather of all misleading cliches when people write about Yemen. It implies a certain weight, but it's completely weightless. The reason why there's al-Qaeda in Yemen has nothing to do with Osama bin Laden's father living there 70-some years ago.
Another apparently salient fact is the notion that Yemenis are armed to the teeth, which sounds dangerous on the face of it, but you believe lacks context.
It does. The cliche is that there's 60 million guns, there's a gun for every man, woman, and child. But it's not really the case. I don't want to underestimate the problem with the arms trade in Yemen. I mean, people do walk around with guns, but a lot of those guns are World War I, World War II era variety. They're part of tribal identification. You know, you see a picture in Yemen of somebody walking down the street carrying a rifle on his shoulder. Most of the time, that rifle can't shoot more than 30 feet, probably, if it can shoot at all.
Anything else for the checklist of conventional wisdom?
Yes, when they talk about Yemen having an al-Qaeda presence since at least the bombing of the USS Cole in 2000, doesn't really recognize the fact that in about 2003, al-Qaeda was more or less destroyed. And since then, since 2006, it's come back with the second generation of al-Qaeda, who are of a completely different breed than the one that we saw before. They're much more ambitious, much more ruthless, much smarter, and more patient. So it assumes this continuity of militancy where one doesn't actually exist.
So on the chaosometer, is it Somalia? Is it Afghanistan? In terms of disorder and just sheer potential danger, where does Yemen fall?
Yemen falls much closer to the Somalia side on the chaosometer. It's closer to being a failed state, which Somalia clearly is. But I think, if you don't mind me saying so, I think that the question in and of itself, when people ask that, is Yemen the next Afghanistan? It is kind of misleading. I mean, we saw that where, you know, when we were talking about Afghan policy, is did what work in Iraq, will it work in Afghanistan? And so I think the problem is the media is so busy trying to figure out, is this next Afghanistan, the next Somalia, that they're not focusing on, as trite as this sounds, it's the current Yemen.
So in other words, I am guilty of asking exactly the kind of superficial, unavailing question that I've been quizzing you about. I am part of the problem, not part of the solution. Is there, in fact, a delicious or particularly trenchant fact about Yemen that you think should be part of the checklist of items to include in contextual stories about the country?
The fascinating thing about Yemeni history is that until 1962, it was essentially a medieval imamate, where people were still being beheaded as a form of punishment. And then as recently as 2004, 2005, it was the closest thing the Middle East had to a functioning democracy. It's really skirted both extremes of what we think of when we think of the Middle East.
So you've described a country that was fundamentally medieval into the 60s, which flirted with democracy more substantially than any other place in the Middle East, outside of, I guess, Israel, and is now a failed state. Can we assume that the state will collapse still further, or is there perhaps just another iteration of Yemen right around the corner?
It's possible that there could be. One of the problems that we had was when we first helped them get rid of al-Qaeda, then we turned our back on them and didn't address any of the structural problems. So if we do help get rid of al-Qaeda again and help the development problems, it can get back to this possible democracy. But if we don't do anything, then I don't think there's a chance that Yemen will be anything but a failed state.
Brian, thank you very much.
Bob, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Brian O'Neill blogs about Yemen at islamandinsurgencyinyemen.blogspot.com. We'll link to his blog from our site on themedia.org. On December 27th, 2 days after the failed bombing attempt of Flight 253, the Obama administration deployed Press Secretary Robert Gibbs and Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano to the Sunday morning news shows.
One thing I'd like to point out is that the system worked. Everybody played an important role here.
Republicans pounced on Napolitano's claims, arguing that the administration's comments, as well as the fact that the president hadn't cut short his Christmas vacation to comment personally, were evidence that Obama did not take the terror threat seriously enough. His critics insist that the administration's rhetoric has been too weak and that the message that the U.S. will not defend itself is a signal that terrorists abroad are receiving loud and clear. Historian Joshua Geltzer, author of U.S. Counterterrorism Strategy and Al-Qaeda, Signaling and the Terrorist Worldview, says that U.S. presidents can signal two ways, through rhetoric and action. George W. Bush's exhortation to al-Qaeda to bring it on was one instance of rhetorical signaling, while Bill Clinton's 1998 missile strikes on Afghanistan and Sudan, which came in response to terrorist attacks on American embassies abroad, were examples of signaling through actions. According to Geltzer, the tricky part about signaling is that U.S. presidents have to communicate with at least two audiences at once. Their words and actions are interpreted not just by terrorists, but by U.S. citizens at home, not to mention allies abroad. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
One of the difficulties that you observe in your book is that the job of signaling potential terrorist adversaries is that it works often at cross purposes with the job of reassuring the American public about our nation's resolve and about their own security. Can you reassure the American public without giving your terrorist enemies the opportunity to exchange high fives?
It certainly is a tension, and it may be that the best way to try to address that is not in the immediate wake of an attack, when the public really does seek reassurance, but in calmer periods. And I would emphasize the role of the government as educator of the American public that terrorism really is a strategy of provocation. On a strategic level, it relies on the fear and, in turn, political overreaction in the wake of a terrorist attack. And so to the extent that this administration can use a period of calm as something of an opportunity to explain that it is in what we do after a terrorist attack that a terrorist either sees success or failure in what they're trying to do, that might be the best way, because not only does it strengthen ourselves a bit at home, but to the extent that terrorist groups see that education of a sort in progress, it may make terrorism less appealing or apparently less effective as a way to approach a country like the U.S.
Your fundamental conclusion is that a lot of bellicose talk and bluster is counterproductive, eh?
Yeah, there can be a lot of things that would seem useful against a traditional state adversary that really are counterproductive against a terrorist group. A state generally does not seek retaliation from its adversary. A terrorist group generally does. Its strategy relies on eliciting some sort of retaliation. in the wake of 9/11, the U.S. quite publicly spent a lot of money building up our homeland security, and there are obviously valid reasons for doing that. And to some extent, there are valid reasons for wanting to publicize it, because it does seem intuitive that certain terrorists or potential terrorists might be deterred. But if you look at what terrorists seized upon in America's reaction to 9/11, they do mention the extent that a terrorist strategy can lead a counterterrorist government to divert its own resources towards things it wouldn't ordinarily want to spend on, such as massive barricades at every airport, not to mention broader expenses like counterterrorist aid to other governments, and really the biggest are our expenses in Afghanistan and Iraq. That is part of what terrorists seek to elicit with their attacks.
Would you recommend to a president of the United States, in the event of a successful attack, maybe in which hundreds or thousands of lives are lost, that he similarly understate the response, that we don't go into full mobilization mode, we don't give succor to our terrorist enemies by overreacting even when the damage is catastrophic?
I think that to the extent that we can react effectively but quietly, that combination is ideal, or at least the best of various tough alternatives. So to take an example, I think this administration, which has actually ramped up the predator strikes along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, has spoken about them less than the previous administration did. So even while engaging in more of them, it's said less about them. Now, we don't know exactly how successful these attacks have been, but the idea of doing them quietly and not exulting in particular successes may allow for the practical success without the counterproductive signaling.
Well, Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joshua Geltzer is a historian, author of U.S. Counterterrorism Strategy and Al-Qaeda, Signaling and the Terrorist Worldview. Coming up, techies are all a Twitter and all a Facebook and all a blogosphere over news of the long-awaited Apple tablet. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The Consumer Electronics Show was held in Las Vegas this week. The annual meeting is a mecca for electronics companies, tech writers, and gadget geeks. And with some 20,000 new products on display, they had plenty to geek out over. Auto companies showed off new internet-ready cars, appliance companies showed off new internet-ready appliances, and one company unveiled a quadruple-bladed helicopter drone that you can control with your iPhone. Seriously. But as far as game-changing devices for the media are concerned, well, there were new e-readers that will supposedly be bigger and better than Amazon's Kindle or Barnes & Noble's Nook, and there was quite a fuss over 3D television. Television manufacturers unveiled all sorts of 3D-ready screens, and ESPN, Discovery Channel, and DirecTV announced 3D programming. But the electronic device the industry is most eager to get its hands on might just be the tablet computer, which, depending on how you look at it, is either a laptop without a keyboard or an oversized touchscreen phone without the phone. Several tablet computers were on display at the show, but no one got too excited because everyone's waiting for the much-rumored tablet from Apple. All we know for sure is that Apple has a big announcement planned for the end of the month, and it hasn't denied the existence of a tablet. Most people covering the industry are absolutely certain that the Apple tablet is coming. Some say it will be called the iSlate and that the screen will be about 10 inches top to bottom. But nobody is sure about anything because we've kind of heard these rumors before. This piece of tape is from 1994.
The tablet newspaper extends communication beyond the written word. Touch the map, and it comes alive, using the tools of sound and animation to tell the story.
That magic tablet never did come to pass, but Mark Potts, a digital media consultant and CEO of the company GrowthSpur, says this time it's for real.
What we've got going for us now is not just the technology is ready for prime time, but there's also an ecosystem around it that Apple can make work to do some very interesting things.
By ecosystem, you mean cooperating partners at magazines and newspapers and app development houses and so forth?
Well, not just that, but the Apple iTunes store, which gives you a way to buy content for it. Apple TV may play a very interesting role, which is a product that's kind of a newfangled cable box for the television that allows you to bring internet content onto your TV. There may be some interesting ways the tablet, if not immediately, but fairly soon, interacts with that.
So, of course, this has not actually been introduced to anybody yet, but as you understand it, what will the capabilities of the iSlate, if it is called the iSlate, what will those capabilities be?
Well, I think it's going to combine a bunch of different things. I think you're going to be able to read newspapers and books and magazines on it. You're going to be able to surf the web on it. You'll be able to look at television shows on it, either that you download or that are streamed to it somehow. You may be able to use it to interact with your television set, watch a show for a while on the Slate, and then say, you know, I want to see this on the big screen and push a button and it goes over there. You'll be able to download music onto it. May even work as a telephone if you want to. In fact, there's interesting possibilities of video conferencing on it.
David Carr of the New York Times just went on and on raving about this technology because he believes that it is going to save magazines and newspapers. He said he hasn't been so excited since he was 8 years old and bought seahorses from the back of a comic book. One hastens to add, those seahorses were a disappointment to everyone who bought them.
They always died.
So are you as gung-ho as David Carr is that this is transformational?
I'm gung-ho in a somewhat different way. I think he's trying to save his industry. I'm gung-ho because I think this could transform a lot of industries. You know, we've talked about this mythical convergence for the last 15 or 20 years of the television and the computer, and it may be that it's about to happen on a device that's neither a television or a computer. It's about to happen on this strange new thing that's not a phone, it's not a computer, it's not a television, it's this piece of plastic that's 10 or 11 inches across and quarter inch, half an inch thick, we don't know, but that has our whole life.
All right, but will people pay a la carte the way music downloaders pay Apple iTunes for songs? We are all now used to getting online content for free. Are we going to pony up on our iSlates?
They might. I think what we're finding is that people will pay for stuff that's really great or really unique or fills a niche. The Wall Street Journal kind of has found that, as has Consumer Reports and ESPN.com. We've also found that there's this system now of people buying apps for their phone, and you know, some of them are free, but a lot of them are 99 cents or $2.99 or $9.99, and that seems to be agreeable to people. This is something that makes my iPhone better, so I'm willing to pay a couple of bucks for it. If they feel that this is something that's going to make their Slate better and their life better, then they'll pay a couple of bucks.
Once upon a time, there was a kind of proto-personal digital everything called the Newton that Apple introduced, I guess, about 20 years ago, and it was ahead of its time and didn't work very well and failed. Is there any reason to worry that the iSlate will just really not be quite ready for prime time?
It's possible. The Newton looks remarkably prescient in retrospect. What really it failed at was handwriting recognition. The other things it did really remarkably well. It also was done at Apple while Steve Jobs was not there. It wasn't a Steve Jobs product. It was the interim administration, which lacked a lot of the verve that Jobs has brought to the company in the last few years. But yes, absolutely. This thing could flop. It's entirely possible.
You're not betting on that, though, are you?
I don't think so. Haven't sold my stock.
All right, Mark. As always, thanks so much.
Bob, good to talk to you.
Digital media consultant Mark Potts is CEO of GrowthSpur.com and, yes, is a, quote, very small shareholder of Apple. So the sudden breakout of tabula rasa went into full swing on Tuesday with an article in the Wall Street Journal. Reporters Yukari Iwatani-Kane and Jeffrey A. Fowler revealed that Apple would soon unveil its long-rumored whatever. It was quite a scoop, providing previously unreported details about the new gadget and setting off an avalanche of tablet coverage. Former Apple marketing manager John Martellaro, now of the MacObserver.com, is pretty sure he knows how the journal penetrated one of Silicon Valley's most secretive companies. John, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Early in the week, there was this very revealing story in the Wall Street Journal, Apple's plans for its new tablet device. I guess that was the result of some unbelievable digging by the two Wall Street Journal reporters who managed somehow to ferret out this information from the notoriously secretive Apple. Is that how it played out?
Well, I kind of doubt it. I could be wrong, but based on previous experience, having worked at Apple and having done them myself, I took a shrewd guess that this was one of those carefully controlled leaks.
Keyword being controlled. If Apple management catches an employee leaking, that employee can get just fired right on the spot.
Absolutely. And that's in the news a lot. People tend to think of Apple as a very secretive company, but you have to have worked for Apple to realize that every once in a while, it's in their best interest to get some information out there for reasons I mentioned in the article.
Let's look at some of those reasons. One is to preempt competition. Another is to signal pricing to see how consumers and Wall Street react to that. And then there's just the issue of creating buzz.
Absolutely. You get these announcements from Apple that there's going to be an event somewhere and Steve's going to talk. And then the rumor mills start and people make some guesses about what might be presented. And then they're very disappointed when he doesn't talk about what they had hoped. So another reason for this authorized managed leak is to make sure that everybody understands that you do want to be there and they are going to talk about the tablet and you better get in line. And Apple hates empty seats. They want standing room only at these events.
If your surmise is correct and this was a controlled leak, I want to call your attention to the fourth paragraph of the journal story, which is in its entirety, an Apple spokesman said the company doesn't comment on rumors and speculation. Now, if you're right, that paragraph is at a minimum disingenuous and at a maximum fundamentally dishonest. It's a charade.
Well, sure. It's all part of developing that relationship for these, you know, controlled and authorized leaks. It helps Apple because Apple gets to maintain that impression that they never talk about unreleased products. But sometimes it's strategically important to get that information out in a very subtle way. And if you have friends in the press who know how to handle it properly, it's nice.
You were a marketing manager, and in your piece, you said you had been at various times directed to pull off one of these controlled leaks. What were the ground rules between you and the reporters?
That if they wanted to maintain the relationship, they wouldn't mention my name. There would be no emails, so there was never a paper trail. It would be a casual, friendly conversation with the understanding that this is information that Apple wanted to get out, but couldn't be attributed to any specific source. Apple wins because they get the information out. The journalist wins because he gets to talk about something that he didn't know about before.
Okay, Scooter Libby. does this all sound familiar to you, that other institutions perhaps do business this way? Like, oh, I don't know, the White House and all of Inside the Beltway Washington?
I think so. Every company has its agenda and information that it wants to get out in its own controlled, focused, and a very managed way. I think Apple's no different than any other company.
John, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
John Martellaro is senior editor for the Mac Observer and a former senior marketing manager for Apple. We reached out to the Wall Street Journal reporters who wrote the story. They referred us to a journal spokesman who said the journal does not discuss its news gathering processes. Newspaper readers around the country this week were treated to a vivid display via full-page display ads of corporate peak. In separate confrontations, cable giant Time Warner battled with Fox, and Cablevision squared off with HGTV and the Food Network. The point of contention was carriage fees demanded by the content providers from cable systems for having access to the programming. All the parties solicited consumer sympathy. The channels claimed viewers were being unfairly denied their favorite programs. The cable operators claimed they were being shaken down by avaricious content providers. Columnist Dan Gross of Newsweek and Slate explains the showdown.
It's a public game of chicken in which they're trying to elicit sympathy. Poor HGTV, poor Food Channel. We'd really love to be getting Emeril and Bobby Flay to you. but Cablevision won't pay for it.
And, of course, the people at Time Warner and at Cablevision are saying, look at these mercenary jerks. They're trying to shake us down to extort money from us that is eventually going to be passed on to you.
Get a load of these folks holding a gun to our head and saying, pay us $20 million, $50 million, $100 million, or else no Emeril.
Okay, point taken. Now, as you point out, it is certainly true that content providers do need a new revenue stream. They did quite well for quite a while, getting approximately half of the ad revenue. But as that shrinks, it's half of a smaller pie. You can't blame them for wanting to monetize their content. And you can't blame the cable companies, whose customers already hate them, for not wanting to tack an extra fee per month to cover what they're going to have to pay to the content providers. Is there any chance that who's going to pay for this in the end will be someone other than cable consumers?
No, and there are two reasons. One is there is a larger shift going on where content providers are making people pay more for content delivered in the ways they want it. The New York Times at the newsstand now costs $2. Magazine subscriptions are going up. You are seeing this across the board in different media out of desperation. All these media that were supported almost solely by advertising are now saying, we got to find another source. Let's figure out a way to charge the user. The second reason is almost more profound, and that is that in this day and age, while we see these battles between the cable systems and the content providers as kind of two warring factions, these are frequently components of the same company. Comcast has 24 million cable subscribers. It's one of the biggest systems out there. So it would be pushing back against paying these fees. But Comcast is also a huge owner of content providers. It owns part of the E! Network. It just did this deal with NBC where it's going to own NBC, CNBC, MSNBC, Bravo. So the discussion is not in the future going to be in public with these dueling websites saying, pay us or else you won't get this. It's going to be within these companies between the content division and the cable division about where the revenue is going to go. And when that discussion is internal, there's only one outcome. They're going to push it onto the consumer.
Mm-hmm. Swell. Now, I want to pull back a little bit because I am myself obsessed with the chaos scenario, the decoupling of mass media and mass marketing that it is at the bottom of essentially the end of the media economy as we have always known it. I mean, we're losing an entire sector of our economy here. And I wonder to what extent you believe that this spitting match between Fox and Time Warner is evidence that the whole ecosystem is just collapsing beneath our feet.
I guess there are two ways of looking at it. One, these are the sort of death throes of a dying regime. The second is this is a response of some pretty smart, very large, well-capitalized companies to a rapidly changing environment. We've seen some components of the media sort of throw up their hands and say, the world has changed too much, we can't do this, i.e. Gourmet magazine. But for every Gourmet, there is a New York Times, which has, you know, recapitalized itself, cut back, make people paid more, built a really awesome website, and will probably be charging people for that website in the near future. So I'm not as convinced that all these behemoths are simply going to go away. They've got too much money, too many embedded customers. And by the way, the upstarts, the online publications, social networks, etc., they haven't exactly been tearing it up on a financial basis.
I'm wondering, though, whether this spitting match between the content producers and the cable systems suggests that when people talk about the death of broadcast, that the cable industry isn't a whole lot better situated because its advertising market is collapsed. It is certainly no more TiVo-resistant than broadcast. And by the way, the same coax that's bringing your paid cable into the house is also bringing broadband in the house, with which any consumer now can get almost all the same programming online for free. Aren't they in some pretty substantial trouble in the medium term themselves?
Well, everything you described is bad news for the channels, but it's not such bad news for the systems operators because they have that wire coming into your house. They're not just selling ads. They're selling reception to you. People have four or five televisions, so they're paying for each one of those boxes. In addition, cable has developed all these other services they can sell. DVRs, HBO, premium channels, sports packages, movies on demand. In addition to internet access, a lot of people get their internet access from the cable company and telephone service. They talk about the so-called triple play, which is
$4 in the first year and $1 million in the third.
But when I look at my monthly bill to Cablevision, it's substantial, and it's because it's serving the media needs of both my wife and I, who work at home and have high-speed internet access, and our kids, who have their own computer and who watch Disney on demand, and we rent movies as a family over the internet, and we use the DVR to record American Idol and So You Think You Can Dance. So they have a pretty good thing going with a lot of their customers.
Wait. Someone in your household TiVos So You Think You Can Dance?
Totally.
Dan, thanks so much. I have no further use of you.
It's a wholesome show. It's great.
Daniel Gross is a columnist for Slate and Newsweek. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, a momentary leveling of China's Great Firewall, plus strange embed fellows, a journalist father with his soldier son's unit in Afghanistan. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John Dee and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The internet in China is highly restricted by the so-called Great Firewall, the government's complicated and constantly evolving system of filters to block websites and searches on topics the government doesn't like. Well, in the middle of the night earlier this week, the Great Firewall collapsed. Websites like Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook could suddenly be accessed without the aid of cloaking software. News quickly spread, and millions of videos were uploaded, photos downloaded, and tweets disseminated. But after a few hours, the Great Firewall went right back up. No one's exactly sure what happened. The government hasn't acknowledged the incident, though some hypothesize that it was caused by a snowstorm, and others think it was the result of updating the firewall and actually making it stronger. Rebecca McKinnon is an Open Society Fellow working on a book about how authoritarian regimes exist in the internet age, and she joins me now. Rebecca, welcome back.
Thank you.
If anyone did harbor hopes that this was somehow presaging a loosening of restrictions on internet usage, to your way of thinking, that's just irrational exuberance. All the evidence is actually the opposite, is it not?
Well, yes, that's correct. The trend over the past year has been toward tightening. And a number of Chinese officials, including the head of public security and other high-ranking officials, have been giving speeches and writing articles in the past few months about how it's important to control the internet. It's a channel through which enemies of China may try to weaken the Chinese nation, and that this needs to be safeguarded against. So the policy has been very much towards making sure that the internet can't be used to foment unrest in any way. And one of the triggers for this, in the middle of last year, in July, there were riots in the far west province of Xinjiang. And in the wake of those riots, the internet in Xinjiang was shut down for many months. And while it has been revived to a minimized extent in that you can now access websites from within Xinjiang, you still can't access the global internet from that entire province.
And this is a security apparatus that never uses a scalpel, when a chainsaw will do just as well.
But I would point out that actually China's controls over its population have grown much more subtle as compared to the classic totalitarian regime. China has many millions of bloggers, and most of them are not staying up late at night worrying about a jackbooted kick on the door. Basically, what happens is that their content is censored, or they might get a warning from their blog hosting service.
Now, actually, on that subject, I wanted to ask you, certainly for 50 years behind the Iron Curtain, the populations of the Soviet Union and its satellites were only too well aware of what they did not have access to. Are Chinese citizens, by and large, aware of the degree to which their view of the outside world is restricted?
I think it varies. There are a lot of well-educated people who travel abroad who are aware of the extent of the censorship. There are many others who don't notice it because they've lived with it their entire lives. And the other thing is, too, the big difference between China today and the countries of the former Soviet bloc is that one of the big reasons why people in the former Soviet bloc were pushing for change is because they couldn't get their Beatles and they couldn't get their blue jeans and they weren't able to have any fun. You know, it wasn't all just about politics. And the Chinese people, of course, are able to buy whatever they want and are able to have quite a lot of fun. And the other thing, though, to point out is that actually a lot of Chinese people, even who study abroad and who read foreign media reports, have decided that they agree with their government's view that the foreign media is spreading lies against China. And so you actually get websites devoted to exposing what they feel are the anti-China conspiracies in the Western media.
It has been now more than a decade of this great experiment in economic and cultural liberalization in China, and corresponding, you know, almost perfectly with the expansion of the internet globally. Do you believe now that this economic expansion can continue, with the genie still sort of plugged up in the bottle, or at some point does it inevitably have to emerge?
Well, that's the bazillion-dollar question. I worked as a journalist in China from the early 90s till the early 2000s, and during that time, all kinds of pundits were constantly predicting that the system could not sustain itself ultimately without political change, and people are continuously being proved wrong on that. I think we would be naive to assume that the world is inevitably and inexorably, just because the internet and Twitter exist, all moving in a democratic direction. There are a lot of trends in the West as well in terms of surveillance. You have politicians calling for greater internet censorship in places like Australia and Germany. In India, there's a great deal of pressure on Google to censor content. Part of it is child protection. Some of it has to do with protecting intellectual property. Some of it has to do with concerns over hate speech. But there are real issues about how these measures are implemented, and are they going to be implemented even in democracies in ways that are not transparent, that end up giving greater advantage to whatever incumbent government is in power at the time. The jury is very much out whether authoritarian countries are all going to happily evolve in a democratic direction, or whether, if we're not careful, we could actually all meet in the middle someday.
Rebecca, once again, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Rebecca MacKinnon is a fellow at the Open Society Institute. India, the world's largest democracy, has become an interesting testing ground for how to find a middle path between China-like censorship and full freedom of speech online. And leading the way in striking this balance is Google, not simply as a search engine, but also because it runs India's third most visited website, a social networking service similar to Facebook and MySpace, known as Orkut. The user-generated content on the site has caught the eye of Indian law enforcement, which wants Google to take down anything that might inflame ethnic or religious tensions. And the modern history of India proves that these concerns are by no means paranoiac. Jessica Vassalero co-wrote about Google's predicament recently in the Wall Street Journal, and she joins me now. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Google is listening to police and government agencies, but they say they're paying more attention to users themselves and what they flag as objectionable.
Correct. So Google won't just review the content on Orkut in India and decide to block it preemptively. The process from their end is that they review content once it's been flagged by their users. And particularly for Google, this is a new country and a new market for them with lots of complexity. They do rely on the users as sort of a barometer. And then they review content brought to their attention by law enforcement.
Can you give me an example of the kind of content that is so provocative or hateful or malicious that the government intervenes to demand that Google take it down?
There were some very offensive comments about a chief minister in India who had died in a plane crash, taunting him and making fun of him. That was content that had been removed. Some other content that has come down or been inaccessible inside India is related to the Shiv Sena group. They're a nationalist political party within India, and there's been a lot of content both in favor of them and against them that's been removed. Other examples include political figures. There were several user groups on Orkut that had some pretty harsh rhetoric against Sonia Gandhi. She had an X through her photo. They described her as Lady Hitler.
Now, this is all material that in our democracy would be deemed just part of the fray, the free exchange of ideas, sometimes repugnant, sometimes obnoxious, but not subject to certainly government censorship. When a government agency, especially the police, does prevail upon Google to remove content, are there Indian civil libertarians who get into an uproar?
There are. People get very concerned when an internet company is taking down content. They're making it inaccessible. But Google has always said in all these countries that it is going to abide by the local rules where it operates. And Google and the lawyers we spoke to there do appreciate the sensitivity that while India protects free speech, there are riots, there are bus bombings, and lawmakers there are very leery of content that inflames communal passions is the language they use. And so that's the balance Google is trying to strike. And there are folks who use this to criticize them. But on the other side, there are folks who sort of applaud Google for pushing back where it does and at least sort of being open that it is working within these frameworks and not pretending that it's business as usual.
Do you have any sense as to whether they are reluctant participants in this, or when the police ask them to jump, do they ask how high?
First off, there's what their executives in India have told us and their executives here who say they push back on dozens of requests a day. And we're taking their word for that, but I think the Google knows that the last thing it wants is to be associated with censorship, because if they don't push back and if they get a reputation, people aren't going to trust them and aren't going to use their services. Google's in-house lawyer in India told us that one thing she's been doing in talking to law enforcement is pointing out examples of potentially controversial speech in other types of media and trying to use that as an argument for why some of these things should be acceptable online as well.
All right, Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Jessica Vassalero covers digital technology from the San Francisco Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. Afghanistan will soon be this nation's longest war. Until recently, it was also a largely forgotten war, and with no state enemy, it is also an extremely complicated war for strategists, members of the military, civilians, and not least, journalists. Certainly not least, George Stanley, managing editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Stanley recently embedded with the Army Reserve's 826th Ordnance Company, a unit that includes his soldier son. He wrote a four-part series about his time in Afghanistan, for which he's received much praise and some scathing criticism. Stanley joins us now. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you all sorts of argumentative questions about conflict of interest and so forth. But first, I want to ask you, what aspects of the story of the war were you able to get through the prism of your son's experience that you otherwise never would have had access to?
I guess it was the questions I wanted answers to, which weren't necessarily the same questions my son might have. They weren't all your traditional journalism questions either. How long Are we going to be sending our soldiers overseas? What are we trying to accomplish in Afghanistan and Iraq? And don't we need to know what the job is that they're supposed to be doing? So those were some of the questions I was trying to get answers to. They were questions that related to having a family member in the military and wanting this thing to come to an end someday.
Did your son tell you anything that you could not report, you know, apart from operational security issues that you felt that because of your relationship with him were just sort of out of bounds?
No, one thing that I found fascinating was it seemed to me that every soldier from private to whatever rank knew exactly what could and couldn't be photographed wherever I was. You know, you can't take pictures of the flight line. And I said, you don't think the Taliban can see the flight line from the mountains over there? I don't understand what the rules are for, but they all knew what the rules were, what you could and couldn't take pictures of, stuff like that.
You had the opportunity to do something that essentially no other soldier's parent is ever given, which is to see firsthand what your son is enduring, to see the risks, to see the mission. Are you now burdened with knowledge that you kind of wish you didn't have?
No, I'm not. No, because, you know, one of the things that struck me, and this is something that I did try to get at least a feeling for this into the stories, and that's that there's a lot of normalcy in Afghanistan. You know, the violence is there, of course, but for the most part, 90% of the time and in 90% of the places, people are going on living their lives. Shepherds are walking across hills with their kids and their sheep. Kids are playing soccer, and most people aren't combatants. And most of the troops are not in harm's way the vast majority of the time.
So let me tell you what I really loved about your pieces. There were significant details that had somehow eluded me in the 8-plus years of reading about the battle on the ground there, the configuration of Bagram Air Force Base and how rinky-dink it is and how temporary it looks almost a decade into the war, how packed in the troops are in their quarters and, you know, how there's no basketball court. And,
right.
And I also like the questions you posed, but I have to ask you, isn't your relationship with the son and his comrades such that it kind of makes it impossible for you to establish any kind of critical distance in answering the questions you sought to answer?
I think I went at it like any other parent would. Probably the strongest responses I've gotten to the stories have been from other family members of the troops who say, you know, these are the same questions we are trying to get answers to. Because even though the troops themselves are committed and gung-ho and volunteers, their families didn't necessarily volunteer for this. And many, many of the troops are not from military families, traditional military families. Many are, of course. But the reservists and guardsmen, like my son, many of them come from families that don't have strong military backgrounds. And so the families aren't necessarily as committed to this as the soldiers themselves and the Marines are.
I guess what I'm asking you fundamentally is this. Does your bond with your son, your love with your son, your sympathy for your son prejudice you in reporting what you've seen? And then does it, by extension, as you so poignantly describe his experience, does it prejudice your readers in a way that should make me uneasy?
You know, the thing is that when my editor asked me to consider this assignment, I said right along, well, I'm the father of a soldier. I could not possibly go there as an objective reporter in any way, and I will be stating that right up front, right off the bat. And that's the way this story is. And because of the way we laid it out, I really think that readers, that they know how to weigh all that stuff and that they know how that would affect them.
What did your son say about your series?
Well, you know, it's he told me he liked it.
Do you believe him? I told my daughter I liked the socks I got for Christmas, but I got to tell you, I was lying.
She doesn't listen to your show, though.
Not very often.
Yeah. Well, there's always that. I do think he's uncomfortable. He's uncomfortable even talking about his own service. They all are, almost.
George, thank you so much.
Bob, thank you. I appreciate it.
George Stanley is vice president and managing editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll link to his four-part series on being embedded with his son's unit in Afghanistan on our site, onthemedia.org. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Halver and Alex Goldman, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.